cases. So the true numbers of healthcare infections and deaths are certainly far higher. So practically, what does this mean? You're home, you have a sore throat, you start coughing, you took off for a few days, you have to get a doctor's note?
Yeah, we have to get a doctor's note for every single time we decide to stay home for whatever we're experiencing, whether that we know that COVID-19 symptoms can last for over a month and can come on and off. We know that being exposed and being working in these challenging conditions exacerbate already pre-existing conditions which nurses suffer, whether that's migraine headaches, you know, diabetes, other health conditions. We know that people just need a mental health day. We know that people are in a whole range of health conditions. We know that thousands of us have been exposed. We've never been healthcare workers are the least tested group of people in this city.
Now, this is a critical point, Sean. If you can explain what you're talking about. So they're saying you need a doctor's note, but if you're at work and you don't feel well, can you demand a test?
We currently, as of last week, can finally get testing as healthcare workers. But for the last month prior to that, we have been denied those tests. So the thousands of healthcare workers, the 77% of our members who have been polled, who have been exposed to this coronavirus for the past month prior to this week, we have not been able to get tested. So they have no idea who is actually COVID positive and who's not. Their actual
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland. At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon has waived the one-week waiting period for unemployment recipients. The state will receive nearly $2.5 billion from the CARES Act. And in national news, Trump backs down to governors. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 17th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. On Tuesday, the City of Portland sent a letter to city employees notifying them of upcoming efforts to reduce costs. Employees of the Portland Police Bureau and Portland Fire and Rescue were excluded from the mailing. The reductions are necessary because of the financial impact that the coronavirus response has had on the local government. Chief Administrative Officer Tom Reinhart said the city anticipates more than $100 million in lost revenue, and that the city, quote, can't wait to reduce costs and prepare for the sharp drop in revenue we face. Non-union employees of the city will be required to take 10 days of unpaid leave between April 30th and October 7th of this year. Individuals can take one furlough day each pay period, 2 days per pay period, or 1 week at a time. It will be up to the impacted bureaus to determine how the furloughs are implemented. Cost of living increases and merit raises have also been frozen for non-union employees until further notice. Healthcare coverage for furloughed employees will be continued. Portland employs 1,700 non-union workers who make up a little over one quarter of the city's workforce. 950 seasonal jobs, primarily seasonal park employees, have already been cut. Reinhart says the city is also discussing possible pay freezes and furloughs with the unions that represent city employees. On Tuesday, Mayor Ted Wheeler announced that he would go without his salary for the rest of the year. The city will continue to pay for the mayor's health coverage, but will save about $95,000 on his salary alone. When the $2 trillion CARES Act was passed, the federal government encouraged states to do away with unemployment waiting periods. Oregon is one of the states where residents filing for unemployment have historically had to wait 1 week before receiving benefits. But that policy may be changing for 1 in 8 workers in Oregon who have filed for unemployment in the last month. As recently as April 8th, the Oregon Employment Department said it would continue with that policy. The agency said reprogramming the state's antiquated computer system would require thousands of hours and could delay the arrival of payments to newly laid off workers. But with nearly 300,000 Oregonians losing their job in the past few weeks, the entire Oregon congressional delegation called on Kate Brown to waive the 1 week waiting period. Last night, the governor notified the congressional delegation that she would work to remove it. Congressman Earl Blumenauer pointed out that the retention of the waiting period would mean that, quote, Oregon would have lost upward of $200 million that would be in the pockets of Oregonians and make a big difference for our local families. The governor's office confirmed that the extra week will be paid retroactively. Oregon received $80 million from the federal government to update its computers in 2009, but the process is still several years from completion. And the wave of recent filing has overwhelmed the system and frustrated tens of thousands of Oregonians who have struggled to file online or reach a live person on the phone. Oregon Representative Susan Bonamici called the unemployment situation unacceptable. State officials have indicated that Oregon is expected to receive nearly $2.5 billion from the federal coronavirus relief package known as the CARES Act. $1.6 billion will be passed directly to local jurisdictions, with the city of Portland, Multnomah County, and Washington County receiving the lion's share. The $850 million balance will be allocated across nearly 4 dozen other programs that qualify for support under the act. Potential recipients include child care and development block grants, hospitals, transportation systems, airports, and small businesses. According to the U.S. Department of the Treasury, money from the CARES Act cannot be used to make up for lost state or local revenue. It must instead be used for unbudgeted expenses between March 1st and December 30th that result from the coronavirus pandemic. This limitation creates challenges for states like Oregon that derive a high percentage of their revenues from income taxes. On Tuesday, Governor Brown expressed some frustration to reporters, saying, quote, we cannot use that to backfill the revenue we have lost because I shuttered the economy to stop the spread of disease and flatten the curve. The funds are due to arrive next week, but city and county officials are still unsure of exactly how much they will receive. They also expect additional Treasury Department eligibility guidelines beyond that are outlined in the CARES Act. A new survey shows strong support in Oregon for protecting wildlife migration routes. As Eric Tegedoff reports, the wildlife crossings on U.S. Highway 97 in southern Oregon could serve as templates for the rest of the state.
Most Oregonians want to protect wildlife migration corridors, according to the latest poll results. The survey, commissioned by the Pew Charitable Trust and conducted in February before the COVID-19 outbreak, finds 86% of Oregon voters think it's important to conserve migration routes for species like deer, elk, and pronghorn, and the same number want the state to build special passages across or under highways to protect these routes and drivers. Ken McCall, vice president of the Oregon Hunters Association, says his group was pleasantly surprised with these results.
It shows a very positive interest on the part of Oregon's public for our deer population health and for the human health associated with deer vehicle collisions that are pretty common in the state of Oregon now.
There are about 7,000 wildlife vehicle crashes and 700 injuries, as well as a number of deaths, from these crashes each year, according to the Oregon Department of Transportation. In addition to supporting special habitat designations, 75% of respondents support increasing funding to build wildlife crossings. Matt Scraw with the Pew Charitable Trust says underpasses and overpasses have proven to reduce collisions by 85 to 90%. He says crossings on Highway 97 in Central Oregon already are doing this.
I do think that we have a template here in Oregon that shows that win-win scenario for both drivers and wildlife alike. And if done properly in the right place, these projects are incredibly effective.
McCall says protecting migration routes is in line with the Oregon Hunters Association's mission to protect wildlife, wildlife habitat, and hunter heritage.
So in order to keep our hunting heritage, our wildlife, and our habitat healthy, pretty obviously the passages and the issues with passage on the highways is something that we can have an effect on, a very direct effect and a very positive effect.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Oregon Department of Education has announced that high school students in the state will not be receiving letter grades for classes they took in the second half of the school year. Students will either be marked passing or incomplete. The revised designations will not alter a student's grade point average. As a result, students who were on pace to graduate based on the first half of their scores will do so regardless of their performance in the second half. To graduate, students must earn 24 credits, including 4 in English, 3 in science, and 3 in math, and they have until August 31st to obtain them. State officials recognize that remote learning may not properly measure a student's performance, and that access to learning materials and family support may also have an impact. Colt Gill, director of the Oregon Department of Education, noted that distance learning places a heavier burden on students and their families than in-classroom. Especially where English is not the native language, students have special needs, or with children of color. Freshmen, sophomores, and juniors who were not passing as of March 13th, the last day that state schools were open, will have until the end of the academic year to pass. Students who have earned an incomplete grade will have until the end of the 2020-2021 school year to earn a passing grade. The demands of an election year and of coronavirus stay-home orders are seen as many to be in conflict. Mail-in voting, which has been a staple in Oregon for many years, may end up being the solution needed in the rest of the country, too. Voting rights groups are praising a new bill called the Vote Safe Act of 2020, introduced in Congress by Senator Kamala Harris. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Voting rights groups are praising the Vote Safe Act of 2020, introduced in Congress on Thursday by California Senator Kamala Harris. The bill would set aside $5 billion to expand voting by mail and early voting ahead of the November presidential election. Dr. Matt Barreto with the UCLA Voting Rights Project says California already allows permanent, no-excuse absentee voting and early voting, so it isn't out of the question for other states.
Some of the more rural counties have already transitioned to 100% vote by mail and do automatically send out ballots to all voters. So we're already seeing that in parts of California.
President Donald Trump believes voting by mail would hurt GOP candidates, but a recent UCLA study shows that no party gains an advantage, and red states like Utah and Arizona have used mail-in ballots for years. In addition, the study found that the incidence of voter fraud is so minuscule as to make it a non-issue. The bill would also require all states to allow 20 days of early voting. Barreto points out that the COVID-19 crisis had made it unsafe for voters to wait in long lines, crowd into polling places, and touch voting machines used by hundreds of other people.
The more options we give, that means that there's less people that have to go to the polls on election day and risk their health.
He notes that making voting more convenient is especially helpful to low-income voters who may not be able to take time off work to wait in voting lines. Senator Harris's bill would also provide grants for states to explore ways to allow curbside voting, to share wait times at polling places, and to make elections more accessible for voters with disabilities. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Foundation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Listening to the KVOO Evening News, stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Stop the Money Pipeline campaign, upheld by local environmental groups working to stop investment in fossil fuels. At 6, we're going to hear Rising Up with Sonali, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather calls for a cool, clear evening with temperatures in the mid-40s. Tomorrow we can expect a cloudy day with occasional rain and temperatures in the high 50s. Today in history, Apollo 13 returned to Earth. The spacecraft had been severely damaged by an explosion on its trip to the moon. quote of the day is from James Lovell, commander of the ill-fated Apollo 13, who said, quote, "I was only a hero by default. The flights were few and far between. There weren't that many astronauts." He also said, "We don't realize what we have on Earth until we leave it." At a coronavirus briefing earlier this week, President Donald Trump angered governors and shocked constitutional scholars by claiming that he had total authority to reopen the country whenever he wanted to. After refusing to issue shelter-in-place orders at the start of the pandemic, governors were adamant that he would not be the one to lift the individual state orders. Experts pointed out that there was nowhere in the Constitution granting this power to the president, and even members of his own party came out against him. Wyoming Republican Representative Liz Cheney tweeted, quote, "The federal government does not have absolute power." During a conference call with governors early on Thursday, Trump told the governors that, quote, "You're going to call your own shots." And at last night's coronavirus briefing, the president bowed to pressure from all sides and offered a vague set of federal guidelines on when to reopen as an alternative. These guidelines are far less detailed than those recently drafted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Those guidelines had been provided to the president's coronavirus task force, but did not appear to have been incorporated into his plan. Pushing the decision back to the states with vague guidelines seems to be primarily intended to protect the president if there are new outbreaks, while allowing him to prod Republican and harass Democratic governors. The strategy became clear when Trump began openly pushing right-wing protests against social distancing that have begun in several states. In a series of tweets, Trump urged demonstrators to, quote, "liberate Michigan, liberate Minnesota, and liberate Virginia, and save your great Second Amendment. It is under siege." When asked about the tweets, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz said that he had tried to call both the president and vice president, but they had not returned his calls. Walz said, quote, "I just don't have time to figure out why something like that would happen. I just have to lead." Based on current projections, the U.S. Postal Service is set to run out of money by September. The $2 trillion CARES Act provides one-time payments of $1,200 to Americans who pay taxes, as well as extending and increasing unemployment benefits. It also enhances the tax benefits to millionaires and makes $500 billion in loans, loan guarantees, and direct investment into large corporations and airlines. But it doesn't set aside a dime to ensure the continued existence of the post office. The USPS employs 600,000 Americans. It's also had to make 50 years of pension payments in advance. The only government agency or private corporation with such a requirement. Yet, according to numerous reports, President Trump threatened to veto the CARES Act if it included bailout money for the post office. Conservatives have long talked about privatizing mail delivery in the United States. Trump has publicly stated that vote by mail is, quote, horrible and corrupt, while expressing concern that Republicans lose out in mail-in voting, although that doesn't seem to be the case in Utah or Arizona. Fans of the post office are showing their love for the beleaguered agency. KBOO's Lisa Loving has this.
And here in Portland, local residents are taping paper hearts to their mailboxes in support of postal workers after the Trump administration announced this week the federal government would not, quote, bail out the Postal Service. U.S. postal officials have said the agency is in danger of going bankrupt because its most profitable mail services have been decimated due to the general business downturn caused by the coronavirus. That's why letter fans are cutting homemade hearts out of scrap paper and taping them up to show support for the service. For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
On Thursday, the Trump administration weakened regulations on the release of mercury and other toxic metals from oil and coal-fired power plants, according to the New York Times. The Environmental Protection Agency rule created a new method of calculating the costs and benefits of cutting mercury pollution. Environmental lawyers said this new system would significantly weaken the controls on mercury and other pollutants. The new method can be used to justify loosening restrictions on any pollutant that the fossil fuel industry has deemed too expensive to control. David Koniski, professor of public and environmental affairs at Indiana University, said the new rule is, quote, less about mercury than about potentially constraining or handcuffing future efforts by the EPA to regulate air pollution. Senator Thomas R. Carper, of Delaware, and Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee wrote an opinion piece for USA Today in November, urging the Trump administration to leave current mercury regulation unchanged. The opinion of the senators said, quote, the gains we have made over the past decade to protect children and families from dangerous mercury pollution should not be lost. Scott A. Weaver, the director of Air Quality Services for American Electric Power, pointed out that many electric utility companies have already spent billions of dollars to comply with mercury emission standards, so the new rule could actually cost the companies more money. A federal judge has blocked the Keystone XL oil pipeline. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal judge Wednesday invalidated a key permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. Judge Brian Morris says a permit issued by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers bypassed necessary environmental reviews. The order says TC Energy, formerly TransCanada, cannot build across waterways along the pipeline route until the Corps does more work on the permit. Victoria Wicks has this report.
Doug Hayes is an attorney for the Sierra Club, one of six environmental agencies that sued the Corps of Engineers. Hayes says the Corps used a streamlined approval process called Nationwide Permit No. 12 that precludes public review and circumvents transparent approval processes.
The pipeline would cross approximately 688 different waterways, river streams, and wetlands across Montana, South Dakota, and Nebraska. And the Army Corps of Engineers is the agency that approves those crossings.
In the order, the federal court notes that the expedited permit is used when a project will result in minimal damage to aquatic environments. Judge Morris also notes that the Corps failed to consult with U.S. Fish and Wildlife or National Marine Fisheries before determining that pipeline construction would have no effect on endangered species or critical habitat. Hayes says the Corps has to do further environmental review and consultation under the Endangered Species Act before it can reissue the permit.
TC Energy cannot build through any of the waterways along the pipeline route until it revamps its approval process.
In two related cases, tribes and environmentalists have challenged permits for the 1.2 miles of pipeline that crosses the border between Montana and Alberta. TC Energy has started pre-construction on that segment. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Judge Morris is hearing arguments in those two related challenges to the Keystone XL pipeline Thursday. He'll issue an order in those cases at a later date. Many tribal leaders are calling for Alaska Native Corporations, or ANCs, to be excluded from funding set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports.
Gerald Gray is chairman of the Little Shell Tribe of Chippewa and the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leadership Council. He says ANC's corporation status should preclude them from accessing the $8 billion Tribal Stabilization Fund.
The Alaska Native Corporation should not be getting any of the funding because they're not tribes. And we just basically don't feel that, you know, it's a good idea to be doing that.
This week, the Rocky Mountain Tribal Leadership Council urged the U.S. Treasury Department to exclude ANCs from the emergency funding. The Great Plains Tribal Chairman Association went a step farther, calling for the removal of Tara Sweeney as Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs. They say since she once worked for an ANC, there's a conflict of interest at play. But Shauna Hegna, president of the Koniag Regional Corporation, says Sweeney is simply following the law.
Simply put, Alaska Native corporations are eligible for funding under the CARES Act because we're included in the law. And we're going to use the funding from the CARES Act to help our communities prepare and respond to COVID-19.
Tribes and ANCs have until Friday to apply for their slice of the Tribal Stabilization Fund. It's not yet clear how the money will be divided up. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
Oglala Sioux Tribal Police have verbally warned or issued citations to more than 150 people on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota for violating curfew or shelter-in-place orders. The tribe's currently on a 14-day lockdown due to a public health response to COVID-19. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Wyoming's deadline to receive ballots in the Democratic primary is today, and former Vice President Joe Biden has begun vetting potential running mates. With those stories and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process.
Holding timely elections is, we feel, a cornerstone of democracy and something that we want to adhere to if at all possible.
Wyoming Democratic Chair Nina Hebert says her party's all-mail-in primary to accommodate the new coronavirus ran smoothly, all things considered. Ballots are due today, the Republican primaries in August. Countering President Donald Trump's claims that mail-in voting favors Democrats and some Republican efforts to make it a partisan issue, a new Stanford study reinforces longstanding research that no party benefits by universal vote by mail, though there is a slight bump in turnout. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar says if vote by mail is good enough for the president, he voted absentee in Florida's primary, it's good enough for anyone. Her name and many others are being publicly floated for former Vice President Joe Biden's running mate. Often called the Veep Stakes, McClatchy, D.C. reporter Ben Catanese explains why it's so different this year.
Biden's got all his opponents already endorsing him. Here it is, mid-April. And if you would have asked anyone if that was possible a couple months ago, people would have said, no, I think this is going to go a long way, you know, maybe all the way to the convention.
So the politicking is happening in public. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer has said she's honored to be on a list that includes former Georgia State House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams, Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, and Kamala Harris of California. All three used cable news to say they'd accept a VP offer.
Biden's got all his opponents already endorsing him. Here it is, mid-April. And if you would have asked anyone if that was possible a couple months ago, people would have said, no, I think this is going to go a long way, you know, maybe all the way to the convention.
Catanese says without a big flashy convention, Biden might announce his pick much earlier than usual.
This big event in the heat of summer with 30,000 people in arena, that looks dubious now. That's probably not going to happen.
In other news, Michigan Representative Justin Amash, a Tea Party Republican turned independent and frequent critic of President Trump, is considering a third party run for president. Michigan is a battleground state with a Republican legislature that has long drawn maps to their advantage. This week, a U.S. appeals court refused to dismantle the state's new independent redistricting commission, which voters approved by ballot measure in the midterm election.
One kind of reform that's really started to take root nationwide is citizens' commissions that take some or all of the power of redistricting away from legislators, and so breaks that feedback loop of legislators drawing lines for themselves and then getting themselves voters that they like and then keeping themselves in power.
Princeton Gerrymandering Project founder Samuel Wang says when the commission will start remains unclear. The Census Bureau has requested a delay due to the pandemic.
The reason that that matters is that that pushes this whole process of drawing lines, maybe getting public input about where those lines should be. All that gets pushed back by months.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
If you're missing your Friday night date night at the movies, the Milton Freewater Drive-In Movie Theater may be just the thing you're looking for. The theater announced that they would be showing Call of the Wild this Friday and Saturday to a maximum of 100 customers and quickly sold out, so they added a third showing on Sunday as well. Showtime is 8 p.m. and their snack stand is open as well, although you'll be expected to observe proper social distancing while you wait for your popcorn. The theater drive-in has been in operation for 59 years and will begin to show movies 6 days a week once the school year is officially over. Portlanders lucky enough to score tickets for Sunday's show will need to get an early start, however. 240 miles from downtown Portland, you'll need to allow about 3.5 hours for the drive. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, April 17th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at our new number, 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Melissa Hood, Eric Tegedoff, Ray Bodwell, Lisa Loving, and Althea Billings. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is The Tireless Auto. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Remember, you can support your listener-supported community radio station by going to our website, kboo.fm/give. You can also donate to us through our mobile app by clicking on that good old donate button. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The 50th anniversary of Earth Day falls on April 22nd, and local environmental organizations have online actions planned, since stay-at-home orders and social distancing mean in-person organizing is not possible. Stop the Money Pipeline is an action against JP Morgan Chase. Danine O'Rourke from 350PDX explains why Chase in particular was a target.
So Stop the Money Pipeline is a new nationwide coalition with a number of different groups across the country who have really noticed that one of the really key issues with fighting the crisis is following the money. And it's a recognition that, you know, we as grassroots organizations, like volunteer-powered movements, we have people power, but we have nowhere near the same amount of money, of course, as the fossil fuel industry. And the money that they have is where we can really hit them where it hurts. And so the key recognition of this is we know who is giving these loans, these massive loans and investments to the industry that's destroying the planet and our communities. And it's big banks like JP Morgan Chase and investment agencies like Liberty Mutual and groups like BlackRock.